Okay, good afternoon. Welcome to a talk by Jeremias Rosler, who will be asserting that assertions are considered harmful, especially in testing, where there's a dilemma at the moment in testing. A lot of people are considering our regression tests aren't really working. People are cancelling them, costing a lot of time. And this dilemma is going to be resolved, at least, by Jeremias. Okay, have an enjoy. Bye.
Thank you very much. So, when we talk about an assertion, just to get you all on the same page, what is an assertion? We have assertions from test automation, mostly from unit testing, where we test code. And here, for instance, you see a very small test where we test Java math function at exact. And we assert that if we add 1 plus 1, then the result should be 2. And of course, this works. And what you can see in that small test is that a test usually consists of several parts. So we have some code that creates a state. That wasn't the case here, because the method that we wanted to test was a static method, so we didn't need to create objects or prepare anything. But in most unit tests, this is the case. Then we execute the code that we actually want to test, so we execute the feature. And then afterwards, we usually have some code to assert the result. So we verify that what we expect we should be returned is actually returned, or verify that the state that we expect, the changes to the state that should have happened, actually did happen. And the thing is that it's very... so if you do it right, the unit test should only be changed if that feature ever changes, right? So you should mock away, for instance, the database. You should mock away most of the application logic, as I mean, depending on the system, if it's possible, but that's the ideal case. And then you test only and execute only the code that you want to test, and that test only needs to change once you change the feature. The problem is on the UI level, a code or a test usually looks like that. So you have, in that case you want to test, you still want to test the 1 plus 1, but now you have a calculator on the website, for instance. And for some reason, because this is a very secret calculator, it's behind a lock interface, so you need to log into the application to be able to, you know, use the calculator. And as you can see, you have some code there that you need to execute in order to be able to test the feature that you actually want to test. And also, you have dependencies that are more or less random depending on the UI. So you depend on the name, on the HTML name in that case, or the layout or stuff, like if you had XY coordinates, you would depend on the actual layout. And this also has nothing to do with the functionality that you actually want to test. It's just more or less something that you need in order to be able to execute the code. Meaning that on the GUI, you have your test usually looks like that. So you want to test the feature in the middle, but you need to log in. So if the login doesn't work, you can't test your feature. You need to execute the menu. If the menu doesn't work, you can't test your feature. And like you need to log out or shut down or whatever. So your code, the code that you want to test, is in between the rest of the application. And you need to execute that code as well, and you depend on it. And if that code changes, like if the login changes, you need to adapt your test, although your test has nothing to do with the login. You still only want to execute the calculator functionality, but you have to adapt the code if the login changes or the menu changes or any of that. Which, of course, is the reason for the famous test pyramid, which says that on the unit level, you should test as much as you can, and less in between, because here the problems that I just mentioned start. And on the UI level, you want to test as few as possible and as late as possible. Like only when once the software stabilized, if it doesn't change anymore, right? Because of the reasons that the cost of agility and the maintenance go up as you go up the stack, so to say. And this example with a calculator is only a toy example. In the real world, you have, for example, something like that. So you have a whatever ugly table that you know shows some random data that you want to test. And if you want to create assertions for that, the assertions look like that. So that's hard to read, hard to understand. You don't even know what it means eventually. Like if this is code that someone else wrote, a test that someone else created, and you have to maintain it after 1 year or something, you don't even know what it references really, and probably I don't understand how that values came to be. You just need to update them. Okay, so this is less than ideal. How can we change that? Well, let's talk about, again, what an assertion actually does. Well, that's easy, right? An assertion does assert correct behavior. Well, what is correct behavior? For instance, if I have a very simple mathematical equation and I say 1 minus 2, so what's the correct answer to that? Who thinks the correct answer is minus 1? Okay, so if you have a calculator, that's true. But maybe you don't have a calculator, maybe you have some sort of system where you have a card and the minus 2 is a gift certificate. So you don't want to pay back money to the customer, right? In case the gift that he has is higher in value than the amount he wants to pay with. He wants to pay, then this should result to zero, right? Then this is the correct answer. Or maybe you're talking about an alarm clock. Then the correct value should be 23 or 59, depending on whether you're working with hours or minutes. Or it's a calendar. Then it should be between, you know, any of those value. It's you're in physics, and this is degree Fahrenheit. Then there is no such thing as minus anything, like because it, you know, zero is absolute bottom. Then you throw an exception, or. So there are many more number of possible use cases that this could possibly resolve to, meaning that even for such a simple question, there is no definite correct answer that will never change. And this is a problem, right? Because what a test does is it takes you the truth and fixes it, potentially forever. So that's the ideal. Like you never have to touch the test again. And this works well if you have a development model like that. Then you have your requirements and they are meant to not change ever again. Then you can write your tests here and, well, you're good. Too bad that today most of us have a situation like that. And you need to change your software all the time. And there is no truth. So there is no correct behavior. Correct lies in the eye of the eye of the beholder. Okay, I have a few examples to maybe make you laugh a bit. The question is, when is a bug a bug? So what is correct behavior, right? Because as I just mentioned, the notion changes. Well, a bug is a bug when it's not a feature. So as you can see, here's a beetle with a feature plate on it. A few examples. In early days, in Unix, everything was on the top level hierarchy. Actually, there were no file hierarchies, and there were so many files that people had problems of tracking them. So they said, okay, we need to implement a hierarchical file system. And then they implemented the dot and the dot dot operator to reference the current directory or the parent directory. And there's this this command ls, list files. And what it does is it just lists all the files. And the problem is that it listed those two as if they were physical files, like actual physical files on the file system. And so what they did is they adapted the ls command, saying that if the first character is a dot, just in the loop, continue, ignore the file. Well, you can, of course, rename a file such that the first character is a dot, making the file disappear. So this was a bug. But as you all know, nobody ever fixed it, because we now have hidden files. The administrators love that feature. So we have hidden files. They start with a dot. And all they did is extend the ls command with minus a, show all files, even the hidden ones, to make the files reappear. So this bug turned into a feature. And another example, you probably know that game, a space arcade, where you have a spaceship and shoot at the aliens. And the thing is, the more aliens you killed, the faster the game got. But this was not an intention. The problem is that at the time, hardware was very not as high in performance as it is today, meaning that the less elements were needed to be rendered on the screen, the faster they could be rendered, making the game faster. So this game becoming faster was not a feature, but it became one. And last example, you probably know Google Mail, and there's this feature that you can undo sending an email. Well, this was an accident. The thing is that Google has services all throughout, and when you click on send, it just takes a couple of seconds to actually send, because you know, you have to validate the email, you have to make sure that it's not sending a virus and whatever. So they had a delay, they had a lag. It took a couple of seconds to actually send the email, and when they wanted to release the product, they couldn't get rid of that lag. So what they did is instead they turned it into a feature and said, okay, now you have time. The time it takes us to validate whatever the email address and that there's no virus in it, that's the time you have to click on undo. So they turned this problem into a feature. And what I want to say with this is there is no such thing as correct behavior. So an assertion can't assert correct behavior. What it instead does is it detects a change. Okay, I want to explain that briefly. How do you do manual testing? Like when you manually test code, you execute it, and then you compare what you expect with what you see. So this can be the model in your head, this can be the documentation, this can be some form of written specification, it doesn't matter. So even if you just imagine what the outcome should be, you have an expected result and you have an actual result. And either those match, like what you see is what you expected, then you're fine, right? The test passed. Or you don't get what you see. Get what you expect. So what you see is different from what you expected. Then you found a bug, right? Well, maybe, because it could be that you were wrong with what you expected in the first place. Maybe you had the wrong model in your head. Maybe the user specification was outdated, or the documentation was outdated. Maybe whatever. So what you see could be the correct behavior, and you realize, once you analyze, that you were wrong about your expectation, right? So, and the same happens with test automation. This is manual testing, but it applies as well to test execution. If you execute a test and the test fails, and you have a look at it, then you can see maybe you updated your software and the test now fails because it's outdated and needs to be updated, right? And with that, I want to say that automated regression testing is not testing, because testing is very challenging. You have to question what you see. And with regression testing, we merely do version control. So the problem is, and I'll come back to that in a second. And if you look at that, where the effort comes in, if you want to automate that process, you have effort here, where you create the expected values, or all those asserts that you just saw, like the bunch of asserts, you need to write that down. This is effort, and once it changes, you have effort to update it. You have to rewrite them, like this, right? You need to write that down. You need to find out what the correct XPath is. Then you need to write down the value that you expect for each and every one of them. And once the values change, because whatever, the calculation changes, the underlying data changes, whatever, you have to update that. And all it gives you is to detect changes. Now I want you to think about manual version control. So if you didn't have Git or SVN or whatever your favorite version control system is, what you would do is you have your sources, and you want to make sure that if you change those sources unintentionally, you can undo the change. Like you can backup. So what you do is you just make a copy of that and call it backup. And once in a while, you make a diff. You have some program that compares the two and shows you what the diff is. And if you say, okay, this is, I wanted that change is okay, I want that. And then you do a manual copy of the source file into the backup folder. Okay, nobody would ever do that. Like that's, we're glad we're using Git that does this for us. But this is what we do essentially with test automation. So with test automation, we create a manual backup, and then once in a while, we create the diff, and then if we have a difference and we say, I need to update the reference, then we do a manual copy of the difference into the backup folder. So this is what we do with regression testing, like if we have that. And on top of that, that isn't even complete. So it detects changes, but only some of the changes. This only detects if that number changes, or that number changes, or that number changes. Like if I have a website that looks like that, and I only check that the strings are on the website, the test is green. It says, yeah, all the strings are there. I can't, as a user, I can't use that website anymore, but the test is green. So, okay, we want to use version control. So what's the problem here? Why can't we use version control? We use it for source files and for static artifacts. But the problem is, a source file is not the software, and the configuration is not the software. Software, this is merely the starting point, because then I have the runtime environment, I have the underlying data, I have third-party services, whatever. So this is not that, right? So I have version control here, but actually what I want is version control here. It's comparable actually to architecture. The source code is like the building plan, the plan of the building, right? So this defines roughly the size and roughly how it looks like, but it's totally different from the actual building. Okay, here I have like colors of the walls, and I have plants, and I have furniture, and I have much more, and all of this is missing in the plan. And this is German. So the gap is closed with automated tests. What an automated test does is it turns that dynamic software into a static artifact. So it encodifies what the dynamic software looks like and makes it static so that I can put it in version control. I can version control tests. Tests are a code. So I can version control the test, whereas I want to version control the dynamic software. So this is what I want to version control. And in order to be able to verify that the code actually loads that data if I execute it, I create a test. And this is giving me version control for that. And as I said, it's incomplete. And it just checks what I tell it to check. And the problem is that is essentially blacklisting changes. So what this means is that whenever that value changes, I get notified. So this test tells me whenever this value changes, it fails. So I notice. And then I can, as I said earlier, I can have a look at the test and say, okay, either now the test is outdated and I need to update the test, or my software changed unintentionally and I can roll back the change or fix it. But it's blacklisting of changes. I have to tell it individually, check this, check this, check this. And if I forget something, if I forget to check something, I never get notified. If I was to configure a firewall, for instance, blacklisting in the firewall is a very bad idea, because you say, okay, don't connect to port 510, don't connect to port 1211, whatever. Okay, you wouldn't do that with a firewall. With a firewall, you want a whitelist approach. You want to say, okay, no connections allowed except for HTTP, HTTPS, whatever. So you open individual ports. But with testing, we do it the other way around. And people have noticed. So for instance, Google has this this approach, whitelist testing approach, because they have the problem when they implement a new feature like that combo box, they mark it on the user interface for the testers. So they have a specific marker, and it shows up as a dancing pony. So when you are a tester at Google, you test your software and you look for the dancing ponies, and you know, okay, this is new functionality, I need to test this, or this is changed functionality, I need to test this. But the problem is, at some point, they forgot to remove the markers. So the actual customers in production had those dancing ponies on their screen. And for some reason, nobody came up with the idea to create a test to have a look whether there's a dancing pony on the screen. I don't know. So the thing is that you cannot check what you don't expect. Like, you wouldn't write a test for a dancing pony if you didn't think that it could potentially happen that a dancing pony could be on the screen. So you don't write a test for that. So this is a problem with black box testing, right? With black box testing, you don't write an assertion for something that you don't ever potentially think could happen. So blacklisting changes is a bad idea. This is the reason why I say assertions are to be considered harmful on the UI level, or on any interface level. And on top of that, usually, so with blacklisting of changes, what I do is I say test, check that, check that, check that, and I get a kind of, I get into there. So I have some amounts of checks that I want to perform. And on the other side, if I do whitelisting of changes, I say ignore that, ignore that, ignore that, and I get into the middle where I don't check everything, like with Git. You have an ignore git ignore file. You don't version control log files. You don't version control class files, and a whole bunch of other stuff, which means that you ignore some of the changes. But I guess that the ideal amount is not in the middle, but somewhere there. Usually, you want to check more than you don't want to check. Depends on your specific project, of course. So, as I said, this is essentially this, only in bad. Now, what can we do about that? What potential solutions are there? Well, of course, you can do a pixel diff. So that's the easiest solution. It's easy to implement. It's easy to roll out. It works for almost any user interface technology. And because of that, there are a whole bunch of tools. Okay, so if you want to do pixel diff, you can use any of those, and I'm sure there are more. But of course, pixel diff is fragile. Like if you create the pixel golden master on your local machine and load it up to the server probably has a different operating system, and you have differences. There are other alternatives. Text test, for instance, is working in Python, and it's turning everything into a text file. So you have a screen scraper that scrapes your screen and turns it into text, and you can have a comparison with that. Or approval test. I recommend this if you, for instance, work with XML or anything. So you can just call approvals.verify and put something in there, a file, a string, whatever, and it will do that. It will give you golden master testing. And just recently, Facebook, you probably heard about that, published a test. Snapshot-based testing is what they call that. It's essentially the same on gadget level. So for individual gadget, it's between unit and GUI testing. So if you have React components, you can test individual React components with that. And what we do currently is, because all of those have some limitations, we came up with our own solution that I briefly want to go, since we're on the FrostCon, we briefly want to go into that. And the idea is that you call just check on, for instance, on the driver, and what this does is gives you golden master testing. So now I want to switch to a live demo. Hope this works. Okay. So, can you see that? Can you read it? So this is essentially a test, usual Selenium test. What we do here is we start the server, and we create a new Chrome driver, and then we log into the system, then we click on a bunch of elements. This is essentially a very... So this is code. That it's meant to be like legacy. So this is a very small legacy application, so to say. So this code is very ugly and very not understandable, and it's meant to be that way in order to exemplify what I want to show. And here you do the assert. So you see that all of those things that you clicked on actually appeared on the screen. So I want to show that. Hope this works. Oh, it, okay. Sorry, again. Why isn't it showing? So, here you can see, okay, I'll put a breakpoint here. So as you can see, here I have a number of products, and as I click on order, I have a card, and the individual products show up in the card, and this is essentially what I want to test. So if I run this code, it just verifies that all of the products have been added to the card. This is what I do here. So, and it works. So, and as you can see, it's as before, it's very clunky and ugly and very hard to maintain. So what I want to do instead, I want to use our library. So now I say start test. And now I can replace all of those assertions. They actually go away, and I just say recheck driver, and optionally I put a name. And so I can have multiple checks throughout the test. So I can have many of those, and those won't fail. They will just summarize all of the differences. And in order to make the test fail, I have to say cap test, and that actually is the place where the test fails. So if there are differences, then here the test fails. Now I can execute that. I hope it works. So again, I'll log in. I do all of that stuff. And as you can see, the test failed because this is the first time I execute the test. So now I need to create the golden master. Now I need to, as you can see below, no, you can't. So the test failed here, and it says, okay, I didn't have anything to compare against. So this is the reason I fail. And now what it did is it created a new resource here that's named after my test and with XML. And here you have all of the properties that are checked, like and it doesn't check the HTML, it checks the DOM. So after evaluating the CSS and the JavaScript, it checks the properties of the individual HTML tags and writes it down in that structure. And if I execute that again, now, because now I have a golden master to test against. So now it's green. As you can see, test passes, nothing changed. Now I can change, for instance, details of the product. So I just changed the price of a product, and I rerun that. Yeah. And now the test fails. And it fails, can you see that? It says, okay, before the value was 15.15, and now the value is 126.25. So this is what I changed, and it detected that change. And I also can change, for instance, I can show that. Now, if I say recap, now I get a file created that I can apply. So, like with Selenium, with Git, you just can commit a change. You can, the Git interface shows, okay, here is a change. You wanna accept that change as permanent, and we implemented that as well. What you do is, we are going to implement a command line interface for that. But here we have the GUI. And as you can see, my test created that, and it shows, okay, here is the change. So before it was 15.15, and now it's 126.25, whatever. And I can review that, and I can say accept. So, okay, in the future, I want that change to be the truth. This should be the change that I want to test against. I say apply. Oh, no. Okay. Okay, this worked in the, when I tried it. Usually what happens is that I can just apply that. What happened? Okay. And if I rerun that, then it's green again. Obviously it doesn't work now because I did something to the demo, whatever. Okay, and it also works if I change CSS elements. For instance, if I change the color and I rerun that. Then the test also fails. And this time it says, okay, what did I do? Okay, I'm sorry. Now, okay, this time it fails and says, okay, there's a change. I'm sorry, I can't make that any bigger with the IDE. It says the color changed. So it detected that color change. And as you can see, that color change happened in one place. So here, I changed the color to H1 elements, for instance, and it shows me all the elements where that change actually happened. So there are a bunch of H1 elements, and it shows me all of those. And now I can use the client again. And for instance, if I open the result, here, as you see, now it says the color changed. And now I can say I want to ignore that. So maybe this is something that changes frequently. Maybe this is something I'm not interested in, whatever. So if you have a pixel-based tool, you can't do this. Like with a pixel tool, you can't say, for instance, ignore the font size or ignore the font type, whatever. Because pixel comparison doesn't give you that information. But here you have a semantic comparison, and you can just say ignore whatever it is that I'm not interested in. And then if I apply that and I re-execute the test, now, as you see, it's green again because it just it now knows that I'm not interested in the color information. So it doesn't check the color information anymore. Okay. So that's for the demo. And it has so this is the many things that are positive about this is that's very easy to create assertions because you don't have a code individual assertions. You just say check and it checks everything. And also it's very easy to update those assertions or those checks, those gold masters. And it's complete. So it checks everything. If anything changes, then you're free to say, I want to ignore that change in the future because I'm not interested in, or it actually showed you a change that you would have otherwise potentially missed. And what it also gives you, because it checks everything, if something changes, so one problem with a test like that is, one problem with a test like that here is also that you need to find elements. Right, you need to find element to send keys or that you want to click on. You need to identify a component. And with that, for instance, you do it here by ID. You give it the ID username. And if that ID ever changes, your test breaks because you can't find that component anymore. The test doesn't know where to click on or where to send keys to, and the test fails. But now, you have more information. You have redundant information. You know not only which name it has or which ID, you also know the path and the label and the pixel coordinates and what else. And you know those information not only about the button that you maybe want to push, but about each and every element on the UI. So you can do a one-on-one comparison. If you have many changes here, for instance, if the city gets moved, the street gets renamed, those two get switched, whatever, and you want to click the accept button, and the accept button now is called save. With a regular test, if you identify it by the label, you won't be able to find it because it now has a different label. But because and the problem is that you only have that one piece of information. You have that one piece label accept, and if that piece is missing, you're not able to identify that. But now what we have instead, we don't have only one piece, we have the whole puzzle. So we have all the elements at once, and we know that this button is that button and that there's no other button there, so we know that this button is probably that button, just by conclusion. So we now have the whole piece, the whole puzzle, and not only a single piece. And that means it's much easier to identify that element. And the tests doing that, your tests get much more robust. So we can say, okay, with a test like that, for instance, it used to be ID username. Now that ID changed. But I can look up in the Golden Master. I can say in the Golden Master, that ID is username. In the Golden Master, it's still there. I can say, oh, instead of just failing, I can tell the user, look, your ID changed. It used to be username, now it's whatever. Please update the test. I can tell the user what the problem is. Or I can even have a generated ID, for instance, something like that. And if that is not showing, that is stable, that is not showing in the UI. And if I reference that ID in my test is never going to fail. Because whatever changes, I have this induced stable ID that I can reference. We call it retest ID because whatever. It's the ID that is generated by retest. And if you reference that, we can identify the element, whatever the changes. If the label changes, if the ID changes, if the XPath changes, as long as there are, you know, if it's the same page and there are some elements that we can make a one-on-one assignment, we're going to be able to identify your element and make the test pass. So, right. So, that's already it. I was faster with my demonstration than I anticipated. are there any questions? Thank you. Yes?
Isn't there some danger by Isn't there some danger by using multiple information to identify this label that maybe it gets attached to the wrong element?
No, because as I said, we have this redundant information not only of the button that we want to press, but of every element. So of every element, we know the XPath, the name, the ID, the whatever. So we can just make a one-on-one assignment. So we can say, okay, this element, it's not last name, it's forename. Yeah, it's last name. Ah, no, it didn't switch actually. Ah, okay, that's wrong in the graphics. Sorry, but I can say, okay, this is called last name, and maybe the XPath changed, maybe the ID changed, but the label did not. So I can still say, okay, this is likely to be that. Ah, now the contents changed. Ah, I see. Okay, and this is likely to be that, right? So I still have some information left to make that assignment. So, as I said, I don't have a single puzzle, a single piece of puzzle. I have the whole puzzle, and I can take all the old pieces of the puzzle and all the new pieces of the puzzle and say, okay, they match closest. And then I can say, this is probably that element. And in case I'm wrong, I mean, you shouldn't do that in production, of course, because if this is a delete database button, you probably don't want to try out. But if you're on the test system, it's fair enough to just say, okay, this is probably that button. I just keep on running and ask the user afterwards. And in 99% of the time, this is what the user wants. So instead of a failing test, you just have a change and the user gets shown what changed, and that he can just confirm if that's what happened. Okay. Any more questions?
If I understand you correctly, the whole gold master is kept in one file, and
yes,
the file is committed to a source control system.
Yeah.
How do you handle things which occur in all of these files? For example, the save button, and you have 1,000 tests, all of them have a save button, and now you want to change it to accept or something. How do you handle that?
Yeah, that's a very good question. Actually, I forgot to show that. Thanks for asking. So now I have a test case with 3 gold masters, and now it should fail because 2 of them are missing. Right, and it did. Very good. And I execute it again. And now it should be green because now I have all 3 gold masters. So, right, and now I change something. For instance, I change that. I hope that's actually captured. because this is still under development. Sorry? I just switched the color to ignore, and now I changed the line height. And the line height actually did result in a change. And now I can load that change. So like that. And as you see, the line height is here. And if I accept that, then the same changes get accepted here as well. So if it's the same change to the same element, we propagate that. Okay? So I say accept. And as you see, so this change here is the same as here. And if I unaccept that, you see? So we just say, and we want to implement more of those qualifiers. So you can say accept all line height changes and accept all whatever attribute changes. We this is what we're going to do with the command line interface. But for now, if it's the same change to the same element, it get accepted throughout. Does that answer your question?
Yes, it does.
Okay.
Would I have a second question?
Yeah. Okay.
what you just demonstrated is inside one test case. So yep. If I have several test cases for the same page, I still have to do it for every test case.
Nope. You can have several test cases and several suites as long as they're executed in one run. This applies. Okay. So there were an additional question? Sorry.
So if you know in advance that you're not interested in like color changes and stuff like that, can you ignore that from the beginning? Or do
yes.
you have like,
yes. Yeah? So right now you can ignore it from the UI, from that UI, but we're going to implement something like the ignore file like it. So you can say ignore that attribute wherever.
Okay, yeah. And also, like in the last minute of the presentation you said, as long as it's on the same page, so how does it track or know which page the elements are on when you give this retest ID or whatever?
Yeah. So right. This is a bit tricky, of course, but the way it's implemented is that as long as we think it's the same element, and we give adapters so that you can implement your own threshold and your own ideas of what makes an element. So if you have, for instance, a fixed ID that never changes, then you can say whenever it has the same ID, it's the same element, if you want to have that strategy. And otherwise, we have a default strategy that falls into place, but if you have a better strategy for your specific situation, then you can give that to us.
All right, thanks.
Yeah.
How do you deal with fields which are related somehow? For example, you deliver or you put something in your shopping basket, press submit order, and then you get a date saying your delivery will be on the 1st of September 2018 or something. How do you deal with that?
So right now, what you do is you ignore it. If it's a date and it changes constantly, you ignore it. But at some point in the future, you will. So this is ongoing development. So this is mostly open source, as you can see here, on GitHub, retest, recheck web. You can find the current version. As you see, it's 0.3 right now. So this is just a prototype for now, but what we will give you is the possibility to define rules, like you would in an assert, where you say this should be a date, or this should be a date that's, you know, 3 days in the future or whatever. So you can have your own check code if it's more complicated than just checking a certain value.
I've got a question.
Sure.
I just caught you saying it's mostly open source.
Yes.
That means the colors are free, or I make a contribution, or is there a benevolent fascist over at the top telling me you can't make contributions?
So the thing is that the UI, so our idea is that we want to, we say we want to create a Git for the GUI. So we create that API that you just saw, which is open source, and the CLI interface. So on the command line, you can use it for free, and it's all open source. But the GUI will be the part where we make money and make a living from. So if you want to use the GUI, you don't have an open source project yourself, then you would need to buy a license.
Is free means free beer, as last night, or is that LPG?
So the API and the command line interface is open source and free, and the GUI is neither.
Okay.
Is it possible to write the files that retest generates by yourself, or are they not human readable? I'm thinking of the use case where you have two people and one person is going to implement a new feature, the other person wants to write the test beforehand, so there's nothing to compare yet, but they agreed on there will be a new button that will do this, please start writing the test while I code the feature. Is that somehow possible, or can you only really work after the fact?
So it is possible in principle. We have no tutorial for that. But what we create is an XML file right now that's human readable. So you see what we compare against, and you even can manually change that XML. And in principle, what you could do is you generate an empty XML file, and you can just mock a screen. So you can have a scrape mock screen, whatever, and the user decides if the new golden master is better than the old one, right? So if the user decides that the interface that your application generates is actually the implementation of the mock-up screen that you put the image there, then you can accept that and it gets overwritten. But that way you can come up with a test first implementation. But we don't have a tutorial yet for that. Any more questions? Okay, so if there are no more questions, thanks for listening. And if you think that might be helpful, you could help us by going on GitHub and having a look at that. Maybe star us or follow us on Twitter or whatever. And yeah, that would be great. Thank you very much. I forgot to mention, this is what I just showed is an implementation for web. But because the approach is very general, we also have implementations ready for XML, if you, for instance, generate XML files, or for log files, if that's what you're in, or for Swing. So we are adding implementations for other UI technologies. Like in a couple of months, there will be added an implementation for mobile for apps. If you're generating that, or if that's your user interface, and much more in the future. Thank you.